just wanted to say hello and welcome to everyone this afternoon or morning, depending where you're listening from. Thanks for joining Red, White, and Brown for this Twitter Spaces conversation. I'm Vignesh Ramachandran. I'm a journalist and co-founder of the Red, White, and Brown newsletter on Substack. This is part of a series of conversations that we've been having the last 2 to 3 months about Asian American communities here on Spaces. Today, I'm excited. We're going to be talking with Rohini Anand, a DEI, or Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Advisor. Dr. Anand was previously the Senior Vice President of Corporate Responsibility and Global Chief Diversity Officer for Sodexo, which is a French global food services and facilities management company. I'm sure we've all interacted with Sodexo in some way, shape, or form. She's recently published a new book, Leading Global Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, A Guide for Systemic Change in Multinational Organizations. And the book covers 5 principles for companies to advance DEI while also understanding local contexts in different parts of the world and in different cultures. But thank you so much, Dr. Anand, for joining today. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful, and I'm just delighted to join you in this conversation. Looking forward to it. And I'm sure others will sign up very quickly, but excited to get started.
Certainly. And the framing I wanted to start with is, you know, we know Asian Americans have succeeded in every sector, you know, rising to the top in many fields. You know, there's, of course, the big names, Sundar Pichai at Alphabet or Google, you know, Satya Nadella at Microsoft, Sonia Singhal at Gap. You know, Asian Americans are well represented in numbers in tech, for example, in medicine, you know, but at the same time, you know, there's this talk of the bamboo ceiling, that many Asian Americans hit a ceiling or a roadblock when trying to grow within an organization. So that's kind of what I wanted to start our conversation with. You know, it's 2022. Why is this still a thing, and how do we address it?
Yeah, I think this is, you know, I'm really, really glad that you're raising this issue, because it's not talked about that much in corporate environments. You know, I think the myth is that, you know, Asian Americans are successful, well-represented, as you said, in boardrooms and executive ranks. You know, they're, what, 6% of the population, but they actually are 13% of the professional workforce. They're highly educated, they're, you know, have a higher than median income, etc. But the reality is very different, right? I mean, there's obviously disparities in income. In fact, I think it's 1 in 4 Asian Pacific Islanders in New York live in poverty. Mm-hmm. We have some of the poorest groups, you know, the Hmong, the Bhutanese, the Nepalese, etc. And unemployment rates really rose during COVID because there's so many Asian Pacific Islander Americans in service and frontline jobs. And then, you know, yeah, they're well represented, as you said, in you know, with the Satya Nadellas and Ajay Bangas, etc. But in the boardroom, they make up only, what, a little over 4% of Fortune 1000 boards. And Asian women, even less, 1.5%. So, you know, this is a major, major issue. And what we see is that they're least likely to be promoted from individual contributor roles, you know, into management, into professional positions. So I think there's, you know, one of the reasons for this is the sort of the stereotypes against Asian Americans. So this whole sort of model minority label that has been imposed on Asian Americans, right? It perpetuates the stereotypes of Asian Americans as industrious, as rule abiding, as quiet, hardworking, with a reliable work ethic, but it also includes a less positive attributes like that they're weak, they're docile, complacent, overly differential. And it's, you know, those things that have really prevented them. So, you know, they excel in STEM fields, but they lack some of those soft skills that are needed for leadership. And so that's sort of stymied their progression, you know, into leadership positions. So they continue to remain in individual contributor positions, but don't move up at the rates at which other groups do. So let me just, you know, stop there and see if that's a sort of answered question.
Yeah, and what I wanted to ask with that is, you know, is this, how much does do the cultural stereotypes, you know, how much is that true, or how much of that you think is used as an excuse to kind of explain these numbers? You know, I was reading a Bloomberg write-up that was talking about, quote, you know, Asian Americans are often held back by cultural stereotypes that can be at odds with Western ideas about leadership. Asian values emphasize humility and deference to authority, whereas Western leadership centers on leaders being masculine, dictatorial, and charismatic. How much of that do you think rings true?
I mean, they're stereotypes, right? So obviously they don't ring true across the board, mm-hmm. right? As with any other group, you know, not sure. all white men are, you know, sort of whatever those leadership model traits were that you just mentioned. Not all white men are like that, not all Asians. So they're stereotypes. Right. They're just completely misleading. But I think this has sort of been perpetuated, and there's sort of historical reasons for that, you know, so for doing that, which... you know, sort of goes to the whole genesis of this model minority stereotype, which really is, you know, a double-edged sword. And the genesis was, you know, because they wanted to, in 1966 was when it was actually formulated, and it was formulated to praise the ability of Japanese Americans to be successful. Mm-hmm. And so they were seen as industrious as compared to African Americans, who were portrayed as struggling against racism and bigotry. So it was really used to compare the Asian group to other minority groups. Now that seems all, you know, very sort of positive for Asian Americans, but it really isn't. Mm-hmm. Because it's kept them out of this whole DEI discourse, diversity, equity, and inclusion discourse, when we really need to be addressing the advancement of Asian Americans in corporate America. And in some extent, it's one group against the other. So I mean, I think it's completely untrue, those stereotypes. So
yeah, and you know, I'm thinking about the kind of the wave of statements and campaigns that came out, especially, you know, post George Floyd in 2020 from you know, numerous companies, you know, across the country and the world about their DEI initiatives or kind of taking a renewed look at diversity in the workplace. To what extent do you think we've made progress on kind of addressing those issues, and what can companies be doing more to kind of ensure Asian Americans are not just, you know, feeling stuck in these individual contributor roles, but can grow?
Yeah, so I don't think that companies have done enough. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I think there were these performative statements that were made, right? You know, I think companies in the U.S. alone gave over $200 billion for racial justice causes, focused rightly so. I mean, it's, you know, I'm saying it's rightly so for the African-American community, because they have been at the receiving end of systemic racism. So I think, you know, that's absolutely the right move, but I don't think anything much has been done for the Asian American community. I think partly it's a smaller percentage of the population, partly it's those myths and stereotypes that, you know, they erroneously believe that Asian Pacific Islander Americans have higher education, high socioeconomic status, etc. And so I think there's been very little that's been done to really focus and develop Asian talent. And you know what's interesting, Nish, mm-hmm. is that the, you know, when you look at the advancement of other groups, it's seen oftentimes as systemic barriers that prevent their advancement. But interestingly, when Asian American population is talked about, mm-hmm. it's seen as an individual issue versus a system, which is, you know, it's those cultural things. It's not systemic, which is not true at all. Mm-hmm. Because it really is about sort of, you know, Western models of leadership that need to be re-looked at in order to be more inclusive. You know, in one study that I saw, over 50% of Asian Americans say that they struggle with looking and acting in conformity with these white male leadership models. So, I mean, I think if organizations are serious about advancing all talent, they've really got to examine those leadership models, right, and see what's relevant in today's world. But I think beyond that, you know, your question was, in what can companies do, right? Mm-hmm. I think there are, you know, several things, and you sort of started off talking about my book. one of the principles in my book is go deep, wide, and inside out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to advance Asian talent, you have to really look at the whole talent life cycle. So, for example, when recruiters are making recruiting decisions, are they managing their bias against accents? I mean, that's a huge trigger for unconscious bias.
Mm-hmm.
And it weeds out a large population of Asian American talent. You know, are they looking at sort of ways to ask questions that draw out the accomplishments of Asian American talent? And then when you look at the sort of entire life cycle, you know, looking at development opportunities, intentionally managing careers of Asian Americans, moving them from individual contributor roles to management and leadership. I mean, we do that with women, you know, we do it with communities of color, but remember, within those communities of color, people have very different experiences,
mm-hmm.
right? The barriers that prevent the advancement of Hispanic or African American talent is very different from the barriers that prevent the advancement of Asian American talent. So, you know, I think managing the careers so that there's mentors and sponsors that are provided, there's exposure to networks, you know, they're given key account rotation and exposure to clients. I think all of these things, and employee resource groups and companies can do a really, really good job of sort of anchoring and providing that sense of community for Asian American talent as well. So let me stop there. And see.
Yeah, and to what extent, I'm kind of curious with that, to what extent, I sometimes think about this as, is it sometimes chicken or egg, you know, do sometimes some, you know, leaders see themselves in younger talent that's more homogenous, and then they promote that, and then it's kind of this cycle. I mean, is that true that happens or not?
Yeah, I think it's very true, and I think with Asian American talent, so you sort of get attracted to those who are in your like, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's bonding, there's trust, and therefore, you know, you gravitate towards that. And with the Asian American talent, there's a syndrome of being a perpetual foreigner, right?
Mm-hmm.
Accents and appearance make Asian Americans look more ethnic. They're seen as foreigners. There's this, you know, and as a result, there's a lack of sense of belonging. You know, on the part of the Asian American talent, there's, you know, difficulty, you know, they're not perceived as American. They're somehow in the heads of leaders, there's a contradiction in perception. You can't be Asian and American at the same time. So these are foreigners. And this is what happened during COVID, remember, when
mm-hmm.
particularly East Asians were targeted, you know, as victims of hate crimes. So, you know, it's like their race prevents them from being seen as American. And, you know, many Asian Americans will say that they don't feel comfortable being themselves at work. You know, there's these questions, where are you really from, right? Regardless of whether you're a second generation American or
mm-hmm.
not, where are you really from? And during the pandemic, there were many East Asians who were, you know, told, you go back to your country. You know, why are you here? I mean, when they were targeted as hate crimes. So Asian Americans, I think many that I talk to really have a need to cover. You know, they cover their food, their language, their clothes, you know, in order to try and, quotes unquotes, be accepted. But there is this perpetual foreigner syndrome. So to your point, the point you raised about, you know, you see people in your like and you gravitate towards them, that absolutely happens. And in the case of Asian Americans, when you don't have mainstream, when they're perceived as foreigners, it's difficult then for people to connect. You know, they don't connect with them.
And
does that make sense, Vignesh?
Yeah, and that you're saying, you know, the idea of that perpetual foreigner, you know, rings, you know, true for many Asian American experiences. I mean, how do you think microaggressions in a sense of like name mix-ups or like I always hear like two East Asian women, they were like, yeah, there were two of us in the office and we would always get mixed up, or like the two South Asian, you know, coders in a company are always mixed up or asked if they're related and things like that. How, you know, to what extent did those contribute to the problem, those kinds of microaggressions?
I think you're absolutely right. In fact, there's a study that I saw which said that 1 in 6 in the survey was mistaken for another Asian woman. You know, so managers may overlook their specific contributions because of that. I mean, if you think that I'm someone else, you know, how the heck are you? You know, so it's a huge, you know, the other issue is also that very often Asian Americans are told, oh, you know, you can fix this. And underlying that is the expectation that you will work yourself to death to get it right. So, I mean, if I look at my own experience, right? Yeah, I worked for Sodexo for 18 years. And when I initially joined, I worked, you know, 4 times as hard, quotes and quotes, to prove myself. I mean, that's, you know, my issue, but that happens to many, many of us. And I'm sure the listeners will agree. And I didn't necessarily ask for help. You know, we were in the middle of this big class action lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And it was my job to kind of turn it around, or I saw it as my job. It really wasn't my job. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just a player in this. But, you know, I didn't ask for help necessarily, because in my head, you know, it was seen as a sign of weakness in some way, which is absolutely incorrect, which is what I think, you know, the flip side to what the company can do. I think what we can do as Asian Americans is to reach out and ask for help, to raise our hand and ask. You know, what's the worst someone will say is no, but to take risks. I think those are the kinds of things we can do. But I say that because I think there was this underlying expectation that I'm going to just work myself to death till I can get it done. You know, so I think both of those things come in the way of advancement of Asian Americans. Both the fact that we are mistaken very often for others, you know, and so, you know, our contributions are overlooked. And then the second is that, you know, they're going to keep working at it till they get it done. I mean, that's the other sort of stereotype assumption that's made.
Yeah. And in your own journey at Sodexo, you know, you were there for many years. Did you see kind of a transformation or not? And as you were kind of, working your way, growing within the company, did you see like the support, you know, improve over the years? Was it kind of a fight the whole way along? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it was a struggle, and it took a lot of work, a lot of time, and a lot of work to really, you know, I say in the book, I say that, you know, transformation happens at the intersection of people and processes, you know, so you've got to work at processes. And I talked about the talent processes, right? You know, looking at how recruiting is done, managing unconscious biases, developing intentionally the careers of Asian Americans, exposing them to leadership development, etc. But it's also about transforming people's mindsets and giving them those sort of, disruptive experiences so that they can look at things in a different way. So I had to do both, you know, and obviously I wasn't alone in doing it. It was, you know, a lot of people working alongside me, but it was, you know, a lot of resistance. It was an uphill battle. But I will say that, you know, as we transformed the culture, what began to happen was, and I've, you know, I mean, there are quotes, you know, even in the book from individuals, and I'll, you know, talk about Asian Americans who said, you know, I was in this company for, you know, the past 10, 15 years. I would never have seen myself in the senior leadership position that I'm in today if we hadn't transformed the culture. You know, it opened up opportunities for me. And that was that piece about working on people's mindsets as well as on processes to make the processes less biased. So, yeah, it is a lot of heavy lifting, but if leaders get it, you know, if they somehow internalize the importance and value and recognize their own sort of ecosystem of beliefs and work at it, and, you know, that often takes an experience where they are two things. One is where they're a minority, and I think they get sort of an experience of what that feels like. And the second is sort of stories, of the employees' experiences, and that helps to kind of shift their mindset. So it can be done, but it's a lot of heavy lifting.
I can only imagine. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the culture. you know, within certain sectors, you know, in the corporate world. You know, in your book, you talk about how DEI has to be implemented in a way that, of course, understands local context geographically, but also, like, how does that understanding of context translate across sectors? You know, from maybe the tech world, which might be considered maybe more progressive, to finance, which is maybe more conservative, to, I'm thinking, like, my world of media, which is maybe somewhere in the middle, you know, depending on the organization. You know, yeah, what can you kind of speak to as far as, you know, context within different sectors?
Yeah, I think there are different contexts in different sectors, and even within sectors, different organizations, right? Mm-hmm. And within those organizations with different functions. So, you know, even within an organization, what you might see is a more inclusive culture and more representation of, you know, Asian Americans, perhaps in certain roles, like technology, for instance, right? Heavy in the tech pieces, mm-hmm. heavy in the research, and less so in sales, less so in marketing. You know, why is that the case? You have individuals who are contributing to, you know, the basic solutions in your organization. If it's research, if they're coming up with breakthrough research, right? Why are they not then, I'm talking about in the pharma industry, for instance, just as an example, right? You know, many, many researchers who are Asian American, but much less so in leadership positions, much less so in sales positions or marketing. So I think, you know, there definitely are sort of different cultures within organizations. And I think this sort of, it's the organizational culture, and it's the sort of the stereotypes of the fact that, you know, Asian Americans can do certain jobs and not others, that have prevented us from moving into other spaces. And, you know, people will say, oh, you have to take a risk. I mean, what is taking a risk? Why is it taking a risk to give someone an opportunity that you have had? Right? We never say we're taking a risk on a white male. So why is taking a risk on, you know, an Asian American, moving them from an individual contributor role to a leadership position? You know, what's the risk in that, other than that, you know, like with anything else, you have to basically buttress that position with the support that they need to succeed, as you would with anyone else, you know, as happens very organically to the dominant group, right? They have mentors, they have sponsors, with long before we actually had formal mentoring or sponsorship programs. You know, they would have other colleagues who would speak on their behalf and who'd advocate for them. We, you know, need to, in order to advance women and Asian Americans in this case, you know, we need to provide those supports in order to make sure that they're successful.
Mm-hmm. And how do we address, you know, one barrier that I think about a lot is, how do we address, you know, the resistance to kind of change, or resistance to kind of DEI work? You know, I think all of us have heard, you know, like, oh, were they just hired as a diversity hire, et cetera, et cetera. You know, how do you think about that kind of resistance?
Yeah, I think in order to break resistance, you have to, as I said, you know, everyone has an ecosystem of beliefs on this topic. And you've got to understand what that ecosystem of beliefs is for a leader. Meet them where they are, and then incrementally nudge them along. It may be data, it may be facts, it may be the fact that this is good for the business. Mm-hmm. You know, this is, your customer base is getting more diverse, you better, you know, attend to that. It may be a client piece, you know, with your clients, they're now demanding that you have more representation, and in order to get business, you need to, you know, attend to what their needs are. So it could be, you know, some more the data and the facts. But I personally believe that ultimately it's those heart pieces, you know, that really help to shift people. So I'll give you one quick example. Mm-hmm. Quick story. There was one particular leader who, you know, mentored a woman who was managing a high security facility. And after sort of engaging with her for a year, he came to me and he said, mm-hmm. you know, if you had presented me with two candidates, a male and a female, and asked me to hire the best qualified candidate for this high security facility, I would have hired the male because you need an assertive, aggressive style, etc. But after mentoring her, and I see that she has a very collaborative, low-key style, I will never let my unconscious bias come into play because she is so successful and she's so effective.
Wow.
That is really sort of disrupting your traditional leadership models, mm-hmm. right? And this guy actually, so giving them experiences that are disruptive can help to kind of, you know, break down some of that, you know, resistance that you talked about. Because, and also kind of, you know, getting leaders to see that this is not a zero-sum game. You know, it's not that because somebody else gets a position, you lose out. You know, this is about the pie being expansive. And that's some of what, you know, we tried to do in the transformation in Sodexo, because, you know, particularly the dominant group, you know, white male managers would say, my career's over, right? And convincing them that, look, if we are leaders in this space and if we're seen as leaders, it can be something that's a differentiator that'll help you to grow the business, which means more opportunities for everyone. Mm-hmm. And they didn't believe it initially till it actually became a reality, you know, that in a very commoditized business, you know, they were able to lead with, you know, with the leadership and diversity, equity and inclusion and get more clients. So that's, you know, I would say it's sort of breaking down those barriers by, you know, sort of providing some transformative experiences to leaders.
Certainly. And then I wanted to close with, I know we're getting to the end of time, but how do people advocate for themselves? You know, they're in an organization, you know, what should they be doing?
That's a great question. So I think, you know, there's several things. One of the other things that I read about was the fact that Asian Americans are the least likely to ask for a raise. You know, they're least likely to. So you know, we end up losing out on all counts. So mm-hmm. I think we've got to advocate for ourselves. We've got to ask for what we want. We have to take risks because, you know, there's no shame in failure. It's fine. It's okay if someone says no. We've got to be able to ask for help. You know, ask for mentors. It's not a sign of weakness. And I gave my own example, right? Mm-hmm. Or inadequacy, but I think it's a sign of self-awareness to say, look, this is, you know, this is somewhere, something that I need help with. And I think that the mainstream culture is embracing of that. So I do think, you know, being clear about what we want, being clear about, and, you know, Asian Americans are some of the most ambitious employees. You know, so to be able to indicate that this is what I want to, this is where I want to get to, how do I get there? Will you help me to get there? I think is a way to navigate career and to move up in an organization.
That's such a great framework, and I think a good motivation for us all. While you're here, this is a little bit of a tangential topic, but definitely wanted to get your thoughts on this because you're such an expert in the space. You know, Parag Agarwal, this week, the new CEO of Twitter, this very platform, you know, said this week, right, he's going to be taking paternity leave. And to me, it was like, of course, like he wants to support his family, his spouse, his children, you know, but maybe I'm sometimes in my own bubble where I think that should be a norm. But in thinking about creating inclusive organizations, what are your thoughts on kind of what's the reaction to that?
I think it's great that, mm-hmm. you know, men and women take parental leave. It should be, you know, that it should be shared responsibility. And I look forward to the day when we don't make such a big deal about men fathers taking parental leave, that it just becomes a norm, because you're right. I think mm-hmm. it should be the norm because, you know, or men staying at home while women, you know, have sort of accelerated careers, all these things should become normalized. So totally supportive of role models and particularly CEOs doing that. So kudos to him for speaking about it.
Certainly. And thank you so much, Dr. Anand, for taking the time to share your expertise and your experiences with all of us. You know, this is a conversation I hope that you know, continues outside of this space, you know, in workplaces and conference rooms. You know, folks, you can follow Dr. Anand here on Twitter at Rohini Anand PhD or RohiniAnand.com. And once again, her new book, Leading Global Diversity, Equity and Inclusion, A Guide for Systemic Change in Multinational Organizations, is available wherever you get your books. And thanks to everyone for tuning in. You can subscribe to our Substack, redwhiteandbrown.substack.com. Stay tuned for future Spaces conversations. We'll have one tomorrow at noon Eastern as well. Thanks again, Dr. Anand. Really, really appreciate your expertise today.
Thanks, Vignesh, and keep doing this important work and raising these important questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and have a great rest of the day, everyone.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.